The locavore concept has become quite popular recently because of claims that it provides better nutrition, reduced carbon footprint, and a stronger connection to what we put in our bodies. But in his book called The Locavore's Dilemma, in praise of the 10,000-mile diet, economic geographer Pierre de Rocher argues that, in his words, locavorism is at best a marketing fad that frequently and severely distorts the environmental impacts of agricultural production, or at worst, a dangerous distraction from the very real and serious issues that affect energy consumption, the environmental impact of modern food production, and the affordability of food. The book, which was co-authored by Hiroko Shimizu, is published by Public Affairs. I'm very pleased it has brought Pierre de Rocher to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
You say the inspiration for this book came from an insult. What happened?
Well, my wife and I, oh, I'm sorry, I should point out, Hiroko Shimizu is my wife. Mm-hmm. So she was born and raised in Tokyo. And about 5 years ago, my department, I'm a geographer in Canada, the University of Toronto, invited a prominent environmentalist who gave a talk on food production and related issues. And he took the local food issue really to its logical end, which is to say that people who consume food that comes from beyond their local food shed are essentially parasites. And of course, if you adopt that framework, the most parasitical people on earth are the Japanese, because they depend on imported food for anywhere between 60 to 70% of their caloric intake. And so Hiroko pointed out, well, you know, we don't have land to grow food. We specialize in other things. We sell the stuff. We buy the food. We don't ask for anyone's charity. So we're not parasite. And so I had to promise her that evening that I would do something about that kind of sloppy thinking. So the book is the end result of that
But
process.
Don't the Japanese believe that they grow the only really good rice? I mean, they have this locavore mentality.
Oh, no, they do.
And they don't want to import perfectly good rice from other countries.
And that's a really sad thing. Yeah, they could import the same rice for maybe a third of the price from places like Thailand or Vietnam, which have good growing conditions. And we're not defending Japanese protectionism, but things would be even worse if they were not importing other kinds of food.
But there are what you call the prime agricultural countries, like the United States, Brazil, France, New Zealand, probably can name Italy, I'm sure.
Canada.
Can't they subsist totally on domestically grown food?
Well, you could.
And locally grown food?
You could, but you would have the same problem that you had over two centuries ago when most food was produced locally. You would do it, you would be less productive because you would have to produce food in less than ideal conditions. And you would end up producing less food, doing more environmental damage, more erosion, and people would be less well nourished. So what we argue in the book is that if you want to help both people and the environment, concentrate food production where it makes the most sense, and that way you produce more food on less land, and everybody in the environment wins.
But then we get into the whole matter of what's the best place to produce the food. For example, a lot of the American produce comes from the Central Valley of California. Where water has to be shipped in,
yes.
and it's an unnatural situation.
And we're not defending that either. I mean, if people were paying the right price for water, then some of that production, some of these productions would probably migrate elsewhere. So we're not defending the status quo. We're saying get rid of subsidies, get rid of barriers to trade, and food production will naturally migrate towards the best locations.
Well, right now is a very good time for local strawberries, for example.
Yeah.
And anybody who has eaten the local strawberries and compared them with the stuff that comes from California, the Driscoll strawberries, will know that the ones that were grown within 50 miles of New York City are full of flavor.
True.
And the ones that were grown 5,000 miles from New York City have pretty much no taste.
And yet
those are the ones I see in most of the supermarkets in the city.
Well, there are two things here. I mean, you've got strawberries and you've got strawberries, like you have wine and wine. A perfectly acceptable table wine might be okay when it's only your family, you have guests, you want something a little bit better. So local strawberries in seasons are often tastier, but they're typically a lot more expensive. So we leave it up to people. The problem is that you can only have, in most places, local strawberry for a few weeks each year. Whereas in California, because they have probably the best conditions to grow them, they can produce them 10 months out of 12. So what we're saying is that, yeah, go for local when you have the means and when you feel that you're getting a good quality price ratio. But the rest of the year, you know, California strawberries are better than jam or frozen strawberries, in our opinion. So there's no point trying to keep them out. I mean, ultimately, it's up to people, but there's no point denying that local food only, in most places, only makes sense a few weeks out of 52.
My guest is Pierre Desrochers, who has written with his wife Hiroko Shimizu The Locavore's Dilemma in Praise of the 10,000-Mile Diet. It is published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Is the title of your book kind of a challenge to Michael Pollan?
Obviously.
Now, he is very locavore in his thinking.
And we think he's wrong, and we attack him on a few points in the book, yes.
So do you see anything positive in locavorism? Because you write, the road to agricultural, economic, environmental, and food safety and security hell is paved with allegedly fresher and more nutritious local meals.
Well, that's the thing we don't understand about this whole local food fad. I mean, it came from people like Michael Pollan, Alice Waters, and a few others who typically live in Berkeley or California somewhere.
No, I'm a locavorian, and I live right here in New York City.
I get that, but I mean, the impetus for the movement started in California.
Or in Italy with slow food, don't you think?
Well, slow food is not exactly the same thing. Slow food is taking your time to eat food, and if it's local, yes, but I'm kind of talking about the United States in this context. No, honestly, I'm glad that people care about the way food is produced today. I mean, I grew up in the countryside. My parents had a sugar shack, an apple orchard. My sister-in-law grew up on a dairy farm. But I teach suburban kids who I feel often have never seen a cow, or if they saw one, it was, you know, from the highway in the distance. And so I would say, on behalf of Poland and the others, the good thing they did is to get people interested in food again. But beyond that, their policy advice is, in my opinion, profoundly mistaken.
You say that in debating with locavores, you found that locavorism is inextricable from its romanticism and its claims of spiritual and societal health. But hasn't the debate also raised public awareness about what we eat and how we get our food? And
that's a good thing. The fact that these issues are raised is a good thing. The problem is that locavores, in my opinion, or at least the people who write about local food and promote local food as a solution, typically give out a number of wrong-headed facts and policy advice. And this is what we're challenging in the book.
And you say that in speaking about your research, people have questioned your motives. You've received hate mail?
Oh, yeah. Well, even I was in a debate 10 days ago. I was called a baby killer by the most prominent Toronto food activist. So that's the kind of level of debate.
A baby killer because what? Because you're promoting poison in baby foods?
Yeah, because importing food from China, I guess, will end up killing babies. I wasn't quite sure. It's just I think my opponent ran out of arguments. But that's the kind of level.
But do you think that food should have a moral component?
Well, it depends what you define by a moral component. Take apple production, for example. In Canada now, apple producers are getting killed by Chinese producers because in terms of producing apples, 75% of the cost is labor. And like it or not, most people in Canada don't want to be apple pickers anymore. People are not really willing to do that. And so we end up importing a lot of apples from China where people don't get a lot of money to pick apples. But
why
in
not
a real
importer
world,
from New York State? We have a lot of apples here. And
yeah, but I guess
it's pretty good.
Well, because the Chinese are more efficient, I guess. But the point is that the Chinese workers don't earn much by North American standards. But in the real world, it is probably the best options they have. Otherwise, they wouldn't do that. So is that moral or is that immoral?
Well, but there's just the matter of taste. A fruit tastes better when it's just been picked freshly. And the Canadians
that
are already giving that up because the apples are coming from China. It's the sugar has already been depleted. The flesh of the apple is getting a little mealy by that time.
Yeah, but it's
or they pick too early, and then that's a whole other problem.
Sure. Well, but it's ultimately up to people. Again, keep in mind that you can have local food in temperate climates for only typically a short season, a short time in the year. And basically, what we're saying in the book is that you don't need a local food movement when local food is good. I mean, restaurants, retailers, consumers will buy it anyway. The problem we have with locavores is they want to push local food beyond what is reasonable and beyond what people would buy for other reason than the food being local.
Well, I think most locavores would accept the fact that it's impossible to grow oranges, bananas, avocados, and other things locally.
Yeah.
But they also promote eating seasonally, and that would mean different foods at different times of the year. The Italians have come up with the problem of not having tomatoes in the winter by coming up with sun-dried tomatoes so that they can still have tomatoes in the wintertime.
But that's what
and you point out that this kind of discussion goes all the way back to ancient Athens.
Yeah, it does. I mean, the Athenians, when they became successful after they had defeated the Persians, wanted to liberate themselves from trade. And, you know, countless polities have done that historically. And when you don't want to depend on trade, typically nasty things happen. We also raised the case of Japan for obvious reason. Japanese southern markets being increasingly, their export markets being increasingly close to them in the early 20th century. And as a result, they invaded Taiwan to grow rice and Manchuria to grow soybeans. You know, people will take their food very seriously. And if goods don't cross barriers, armies will eventually. So taken to its logical extreme, we prove in the book, I believe, that preventing people from trading will have very nasty consequences.
We have a call from Steve from Brooklyn. Steve, you're on the air.
I wanted to sort of the critique of Japan, I think, is a valid one, because if you look at Japanese history, you know, they've sort of got a history of going beyond their borders to get what they need to maintain themselves. And I think whether you want to call them parasitic or imperialist, you only have to look at World War II or even, you know, the overfishing of Asian waters to see a country that's not able to sustain itself and should maybe be taking better, attempts at managing its own resources rather than always going abroad to constantly be, looking further afield. And I think that's part of the locavore ethos, if you want to call it that.
Well, I'm glad my wife isn't here to answer you.
Nothing personal against your wife, with all due respect.
No, but what I would say is that I don't know if you've been to Japan, but it's a very crowded country. I mean, they have a lot of greenery from the air, but these are very steep slopes, and you just cannot grow anything there. And it so happens that Japanese people were born there and that they specialize in doing other things. I don't know where you live, but chances are you might be driving a Japanese car and that a lot of the electronics that you use had some components manufactured in Japan. So what is wrong with the Japanese doing that and importing food from people who have more agricultural land than they need?
Well, I think maybe we're all contributing in some ways to this problem. I mean, if that's just one example.
Steve, thank you for your call. A listener left this comment: eating food locally is how humans have operated for thousands of years. Common sense would say you shouldn't be able to eat strawberries 10 months of the year unless you live where they grow for 10 months of the year.
Well, your mind might think that, but not your body. I mean, what we've seen in the last two centuries with the advent of the railroad, the steamship, and then integrated container shipping is that humans have become much taller and healthier than they used to be. I mean, we're tropical animals. We evolved to live in places like Kenya, where the average temperature, I'm sorry, I'm Canadian, hovers between 15 and 28 degrees Celsius a year. We're not genetically engineered to live in places like the Northeast U.S. or Canada. So there's no point in trying to live on the local food chain. We could not survive. But beyond that, the point that we make in the book is that defeating seasonality was one of humanity's greatest achievements. Your body needs minerals, vitamins, proteins. It doesn't care where it comes from. It doesn't care how it's produced. And the more we have of it, the longer and healthier we are.
Well, perhaps if you'd come from France rather than from French Canada, you might have a different take on this. Regionalism is a way of life in France and Italy and other countries in Europe. And when you eat in Europe these days, even today, most of the ingredients of a meal, even the wine, are likely to have been produced locally. As a result, we talk about how much,
but we're not
how
yet.
Great French food is. When French restaurants open up here, they actually buy locally.
Well, my ancestors on both my father's and mother's side are from the mid-Atlantic region of France, La Rochelle, if that tells anything to you. Yeah. So yeah, La Rochelle was great, I guess. But then for some reasons, my ancestors were crazy enough three centuries ago to cross the Atlantic and move to the St. Lawrence Valley, where, you know, the extremes in temperatures are very high and where your winter diet is really horrible. So living in France back in those days was probably not all that great to begin with. But again, of course, things are better nowadays, but not all of us live in locations like that. And we need people to produce the kind of resources that we produce in Canada. I mean, we have more petroleum and more minerals, for example, than France. And so we trade with them. We import French cheese and wine, which they produce in abundance, and we send them other stuff. And we believe that it's a win-win situation.
Well, you do produce a couple of nice wines in Canada, but they're mostly ice wines.
They're mostly ice wines, but that's the thing. I mean, do you know how expensive they are?
My guest is Pierre Desrochers, who's written a book called The Locavore's Dilemma in Praise of the 10,000-Mile Diet. He's written with in collaboration with his wife, Hiroko Shimizu. It is published by Public Affairs. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Pierre Desrochers, who with Hiroko Shimizu has written The Locavore's Dilemma in Praise of the 10,000-Mile Diet. It is published by Public Affairs. You say that you had a few preconceived opinions going into this project. What were they?
Well, I don't tend to romanticize agricultural life. I mean, for me, again, I grew up in the countryside. Producing food is a job. And in my experience, a lot of people who grew up in the suburbs or in the city tend to idealize life in the countryside. So one of the things that I really do not idealize is subsistence farming in less advanced economies. And what we argue in the book is that historically, people, when given the opportunity, will move to cities where they will depend on imported food rather than remain subsistence farmers forever. So people should have the opportunity to get out of farming if they want to, which, again, is something that not many locavores think is apparently a good thing.
Well, there are many people who are also choosing to go back into farming or to maintain the family farm if they can. So not everyone agrees with that.
No, but if you look at the numbers, I mean, today in advanced economies, over 80% of people live in very large metropolitan agglomerations. And you go back again 2 centuries, it might have been 10%. So we argue that overall, the vast majority of people, when given the opportunity, will want to get out of farming, and they should not be forced to remain in it.
We have a call from Kevin from Middletown, New Jersey. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to ask your guest, this is an interesting conversation, about the cost of shipping all of this food around the country. If his thesis implies that it's the shipping just happens without any use of fossil fuels, which aren't renewable and whatnot. So how do you factor in the use of fossil fuels to ship things 10,000 miles?
Okay, well, I mean, the back of the envelope calculations that have been done by other people than me tend to point out that in the United States, about 4% of the energy used in agriculture is used in long-distance transportation, and about 83% in production, you know, things like heating greenhouses, manufacturing fertilizers, powering pumps to provide irrigation water to field. So even if you cut transportation a little, that 4% part, you increase the 83% part even more. So in the grander scheme of thing, transportation is really not an issue. We discussed the issue of peak oil to a large extent in the book. And what we point out is that even in the worst-case scenario, let's assume that some aliens land on this planet and steal our best oil resources, we should remember that the long-distance trade in food really began with coal, and that there was a substantial serving of coal between local food and petroleum. And nobody denies that we have coal for several centuries. So we will never revert back to the kind of local food systems that locavore dream of for several centuries at least, even in the absolute worst case scenario.
Thank you for calling, Kevin.
Sure.
But you say an increase in local food production will lead to more environmental damage than currently exists. That goes beyond what you just said to Kevin.
Sure. Oh, no, but of course. I mean, you've got to look historically what happened when people had no access to long-distance transportation. So typically, people would favor calories over variety. So let's say growing wheat or cereal grains, as opposed to growing fruits and vegetables. And in places like the Shenandoah Valley, for example, which is a case we use in the book, people would grow wheat on very hilly slopes where the soil conditions were poor, the environment was full of rock. They had no choice. They had to grow their own food to eat. But they would produce a lot of erosion in the process. I mean, the Mediterranean today looks so dry and so damaged because historically people were growing their cereals next to where they live. But by shifting grain cultivations to places like the Northern Plains in the United States, the Canadian prairies, Australia, and Argentina, you grow grain and wheat, especially in almost ideal condition. You have virtually no erosion. And so people gave up on growing cereals in places like the Shenandoah and instead turned their land into pasture land or orchard. And we argue that in the process, nature was made much better off.
So when I go to my local green market and there's somebody who has who's selling grain that have been grown on local land, wheat and oats and whatever, and then milled it themselves, I'm actually doing harm to the environment?
Well, what I'm saying is that it depends where it is grown, of course. A lot of soft wheat is grown in Pennsylvania, and you know, if it is produced locally, it might make sense, depending, again, on the location where it is from. But chances are that you will pay a lot more for it. And in the end, what we argue is that price do tell you something. It is that resources are used less efficiently than they could be. You could probably grow the same amount of wheat on a lot less land using a lot less input if it came from another location. Yes.
No, go ahead.
No, so the point we're making in the book is that efficiency does matter. There are such things as economies of scale in food production, and having economies of scale allows us to produce a lot more food on a lot less land. And if you want to help nature, stay away from it. This is why you should concentrate food production where it makes the more sense.
Well, there's always a trade-off. I've visited a dairy farm with a farmer who actually is going against the standard dairy farm approach, the agribusiness approach. And he says he's breeding his cows back to the Neolithic age. They produce less milk, but they live longer and produce more milk in the long run. So he says the trade-off is, do you genetically breed a cow to live just a few years and produce a lot of milk, or do you let that cow live longer and wind up producing as much, if not more, milk?
Well, it depends. I mean, you've got to compare several cows that have shorter lives with a cow that lives a longer life. And I would argue that if you look strictly at dairy yields, if I can use that expression, they're probably still higher with the modern approach. The point that we're making in the book is that things happen for a reason. I mean, a lot of people think that we have agribusiness today because of subsidies, because of all sorts of evil things, which is true in part. But we also have agribusiness because, again, there are such things as economies of scale. People, listen, you don't drive around in a Ford Model T anymore. A Ford Model T is a nice thing, but it belongs in a museum. And a cow that came from the Neolithic might help a local farmer survive if he sells his milk, if he gets a lot more money for it than other people. But 1910 or 2000 BC technologies do not belong in modern farming.
We keep on talking about this with ignoring to me, a very important thing, which is taste. Eating an heirloom tomato, which cannot be produced by an agribusiness, is an exciting experience. It usually
and
just tastes a lot better. Sure, I'm not going to eat them every day. I can't afford to eat them every day. But I would prefer to have them, and I would prefer to have the milk from that cow, which, by the way, tastes better. To me, and I can go on and on and on about all the different things.
And I have
that
absolutely no problem with that. You have to understand, though, look at dairy production, for example. Historically, New York City had a lot of dairy cows. They were fed on the local brewery leftovers, spent grain, that kind of stuff. And dairy production only became a rural activity in a place like New York, really, with the advent of the railroad. Before that, you could not preserve milk, so what farmers in upstate New York would do was to produce butter and ship it to New York City. So sending milk actually to New York City required advances in long-distance transportation. And one of the reasons people switched that was that they were saying milk produced far from New York City actually tasted a lot better than milk produced in New York City. Taste was actually a big thing when that happened. No, what we're saying in the book is that, fine, I mean, you will always have a niche market for more expensive products, and we don't have a problem with that. But if locavores say that we should promote local food to make it more accessible to a large number of consumers, no, I'm sorry, it won't happen.
Well, they're also saying that if we took the subsidies that we give to agribusinesses and instead gave them to local farmers, to smaller farmers who are excluded from those subsidies, then we would be paying less for the locally grown produce, and we'd be eating healthier.
Well, I'm all for scrapping subsidies. Again, I'm Canadian, and we do suffer from stupid American agricultural policy. I mean, no offense intended, not to this audience anyway. But the fact is that, again, there are such things as economies of scale. Farms were big or were getting bigger even before before the New Deal came along in this country, because there are, again, economies of scale in agricultural production, just like there are economies of scale in producing cars and other goods. So scrap subsidies for everybody. And then you will have small, local, niche producers who will produce things that might cost two or three times more, but will find a customer base. And you will have commodity producers in further along the road that will produce cheaper, acceptable food for a larger number of people.
One of my listeners, John in Brooklyn, writes, Mr. DeRocher's argument seems to perpetuate capitalism's greatest failings. Does the present economic crisis not sufficiently expose the dangers of concentrating too much in the hands of a very few? How does this sound like anything other than an awful idea when it's the global food supply?
Do you know anything about Soviet agriculture? You think things were better in the Soviet Union? They were starving. They had to open up to world markets in 1973 because their wheat crops were failing repeatedly. I mean, our system is not perfect, but I would argue that a lot of the problems right now can be traced back to subsidies and really stupid agricultural policies rather than trade and any economies of scales.
A caller wonders if there is any monitoring of imported food on an international level, since food safety standards vary between countries, and some countries are still spraying their crops with DDT.
Well, we were talking about strawberries before. You should see what Canadian local food activists say about American strawberries, by the way. I mean,
we do have some that say no spraying, but they do cost more.
Well, what we argue in the book is that what matters is how the food is produced, not where it is produced. And there are, believe it or not, producers in less advanced economies who follow very strict standards, and we should not penalize them unduly because other producers might not be following those standards. And there are plenty of American producers, too, who have problems with salmonella, listeriosis, who make people sick, who are small farmers who are doing the best they can but don't have the knowledge and the resources to monitor these problems.
A listener in your defense says any moral benefits of locally sourced food are severely undermined by the cost rising to an unaffordable level for many working people, not to mention that without industrial farming methods, not that these couldn't be improved, many people worldwide would starve. Traditional methods simply will not produce enough food to feed our planet's huge population.
Well, that's what happened historically. I mean, people don't understand that one of the main drivers behind the globalization of our food supply chain was exactly food security, because when people depended on local food for their supply, two bad harvests in a row and you would have a famine, no matter where you were the world over. And famine only disappear with the advent of long-distance trade.
Can you talk about the Santa Barbara syndrome?
Oh, okay. How much time do I have?
Make it brief.
Well, a lot of people are upset with the idea of producing a lot of food locally, exporting it in other places, and importing food at certain times of the year. So Santa Barbara ships a lot of vegetables and fruits to other parts of the United States, but does import a substantial amount of what it produces. What people don't understand is that a lot of the stuff that they import comes from the southern hemisphere, where our winter happens to be their summer and vice versa. So it actually makes sense, if you want to cut down on the cost of storage and spoilage associated with storage, to produce locally as much as you can, export most of it, and import from other countries when these local crops are in season in other locations.
It still seems kind of crazy. Santa Barbara exports most of its product, its produce, and then imports what it eats.
No, it's not, because, there are a few months in the year where they don't produce, and instead of keeping things in storage for, let's say, 3 or 4 months, it makes more sense to import fresh fruit from places like New Zealand. And they export about 9 times more than they import.
You write, if purchased on a large scale, local food consumption would result in greater environmental damages, reduced economic growth, and significantly more food insecurity than is now the case.
Yeah, backward is the new forward, according to locavores. But again, you have to ask yourself, well, if things were so great, why do we have a globalized food supply chain? And increasing local food production will bring less quality land under production, will make the food more expensive. And again, no matter where you are in the world, you will have bad years and you won't be able to tap into the surplus of other regions.
You even are a bit critical of farmers markets in this book.
Well, we are, because people assume that you can trust everybody you meet in a farmer's market, and I challenge you to Google farmer's market and fraud and see the number of stories that do pop up. There are a reason why we develop brands and why large supermarkets have no incentive to lie to you. They're much more vulnerable to lawsuits than small fly-by-night operations at farmer's markets. So I believe that most people at local farmer's markets are honest, but you're more likely to run into dishonest people or being sold things under false pretenses at a farmer's market than in a large supermarket.
Well, the green markets in New York City go to the farms to make sure that they are actually doing what they say. But you are even critical of cranky farmers. Well, most of the people who are selling the stuff.
Trust me, I know. I know my neighbors where I grew up.
But most of the people who are selling this stuff are actually locals who have been hired by the farmers because they're off growing other stuff. Yeah. Michael in Manhattan asks, how do you feel about food overproduction and waste? Over 40% of food is wasted in this country.
Exactly, and that's a much more important issue than food, Miles. And what we point out in the book is that you want to tackle a serious food problem, focus on that rather than promoting local food production. You waste less food, you need to produce less in the first place, everybody will benefit.
So you set out to anger people, and judging from
I set out to defend the honor of my wife.
This is not really a book about defending Japan, is it?
Yeah, I wish I would have read my wife. Trust me.
Obviously, if it were just about Japan, you would not be talking about all these other things that happen in Canada and the United States.
And again, as we said at the beginning, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and we believe that local food is a typical case.
Pierre Desrochers and Hiroko Shimizu have written a book called The Locavore's Dilemma in praise of the 10,000-mile diet, although I don't think we should take you seriously or literally on that 10,000-mile diet being the only diet that we should rely on. The book is published by Public Affairs, and I thank you so much for stopping by and giving us such a stimulating conversation.
Well, thanks for having me.